Joining me on this edition of Our Town is our Chief Medical Officer at Peace Health, Peace Harbor Hospital, Dr. MacArthur, and Jason Hawkins, who is our CAO, Chief Administrative Officer there at the hospital. How are you both doing?
Great. Good morning.
I haven't seen you since last April, I think.
It's been a
while. I saw you briefly, but yeah, it's been a while. And it was fun the last time I saw you. I'm sorry. It's all HIPAA stuff. I could talk about it, but you can't.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk about what's going on in hospital systems first, maybe around the country and around the state, due to the last couple of years and the way the economics have been going. Who wants to start? Maybe.
Yeah, I think I'll take a swing at that one, and Dr. MacArthur can jump in from a clinical patient perspective. Certainly, I think it's probably fair to say that. The payment methodologies, how we're reimbursed, are often set several years prior to when we actually get paid. And oftentimes, 1% and 2% increases, if that, sometimes they're actually decreases that are happening to hospitals and provider practices. So nowhere in our reimbursement landscape would it account for the type of inflation that we're experiencing with increased wages, temporary traveling nurses, the cost of equipment, the cost of supplies. We've been seeing double-digit type of expense growth over the last few years. And it's certainly challenging, taking its toll, and I think probably every health system is looking at how to tighten their belt a little bit, looking at what programs they offer, and trying to sort out, making sure they don't drift from their mission too far.
How does it differ from a nonprofit to a for-profit situation there? Is there a payment imbalance in that makeup too?
I don't know if it's so much from a for-profit or nonprofit in healthcare. Generally, these rules are given to us by the federal or state government payers. You have a little bit of flexibility in negotiation with the commercial payers, but that represents maybe 20% of our patients. So the other 70-80% is really being kind of dictated, mandated by the federal and state government payment guidelines.
But doesn't a not-for-profit like the Peace Health System, don't they have more challenges in raising money and covering those expenses?
Yeah, I think that nonprofits, I think historically across the country, have been more mission-centric, and not that the for-profits aren't, but I think those were kind of how we were founded and how we were kind of born in each of our communities, was because there was a hospital needed and there were physicians needed, and people came together to make that happen.
On the in a clinical basis, how does that change for the physicians? As far as, they got that mission statement of, it's almost like the soldier leaving no one behind, you got to take care of everybody. How does that affect, does it affect, doctor payments, salary payments? Does it in this clinical setting?
That's a great question. I think first what I would say is we would never refuse care to anyone, right? So no matter who comes in the door, we're going to take care of them and we're going to do the right thing for that patient. I think in the end, we know that there's going to be patients who can't pay those bills. And as a physician, I don't think about that. I think about doing the right thing and hopefully it'll work out the best for the company. But I don't think that ever crosses the mind of most physicians or providers at all. They're just trying to get the right thing done. I think it's been very frustrating for the outpatient providers, though, more so than the inpatient providers. For the outpatient providers, there's been a lot of struggle for getting things approved, right? So from an inpatient and a emergency provider side, they don't have to worry about that, but those outpatient providers do.
Before you move on, tell me the difference between an inpatient provider and an outpatient provider.
Oh, okay. I'd love to explain. So we have the provider that when you come to the emergency department, you have a physician that you see there. That emergency physician is considered a hospital-based provider. They're the ones that attend to you in that emergency need. An inpatient provider would be someone who would take care of you while you're hospitalized. So maybe a hospitalist or the surgeon that might do your surgery while you're in the hospital. And then an outpatient provider would be someone that you would see like your primary care provider, or let's say the women's care provider that you went to, the OBGYN that saw you in the clinic, or the cardiologist that saw you in the clinic, or even the podiatrist that you went to finally get that toe taken care of that you needed so badly. So those outpatient providers are those providers.
Okay, now go back and explain to me again the difficulties between that the two are having.
Sure. So the inpatient or the hospital-based providers, they often are not seeing the end where those who take care of the reimbursement of the payment for them, they don't really see that. They're so focused on patient care that they don't really need to worry about how that reimbursement is
done.
Business
end of it. Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be aware of the business end. However, on the outpatient side, so many of those providers do have to almost fight at times to get certain procedures, let's say, approved for a patient. So let's say a patient goes in and they're needing to have a colonoscopy, for example, and they have a particular kind of insurance. And so they, your primary care provider says, you need a colonoscopy, it's time for that. They make a referral, you go to your GI specialist for that. And then the GI specialist says, yep, absolutely, it's time for that colonoscopy. And then whatever insurance it is has to approve that colonoscopy. And now the process begins of approval. And what we're seeing is that that process for even routine procedures has grown even more difficult in this climate. And so that increasing difficulty, that's what happens with those outpatient providers, is jogging through that referral system, trying to get things approved, anything from home health for a patient to nursing care that they might need to getting a medication approved. That's probably the biggest one that we fight, is getting the right medication approved for the right reason.
So the burden of care is almost largely on them to get things done.
Yeah.
Has that changed? Like, for example, I know that with people that are getting colonoscopies, you know, the average for most people is every 5 years, you know, at a certain age. But sometimes if the doctor sees something, they'll say, hey, I want to see every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Does that make it more difficult for approval as well?
It can. Yeah. And it really depends on the provider having done a very good job of documenting and showing why it's necessary. It's interesting that there's so many times when I used to work in outpatient medicine, it helps me to, as I support these outpatient providers, they'll even at times have to call and speak to another provider that's working for that insurance company and actually have what's called a doc-to-doc, where they're actually trying to justify that happening, to explain why they might need that colonoscopy in 2 years, or submit photos from that previous colonoscopy to show why it was necessary.
So then in an inpatient setting, then the burden of care is on the administrative side, then trying to gather and get the monies that are owed.
It is. And sometimes where we see that is because it's emergent care, oftentimes there's not any issues that you went in for a medical emergency, medical surgery, a motor vehicle accident, those kind of things. So those are not scheduled. So the barriers aren't there. We don't have to advocate for the patient like we do on the outpatient side. Where we do have to watch it a little bit on the inpatient side is at times during a patient's length of stay while they're admitted, certain payers will be asking, you know, or is there still a need for them to be in the hospital? You know, can you discharge them? So there's always, forces at work to try to encourage patients to be discharged sooner, and trying to work through that.
I always wondered, you know, I don't know what your ages are, but I'm, you know, 62, and I know that when I was born, you know, the standard was 3-4 days for the mother to be in the hospital. Now it's almost, you know, they're almost out the door if everybody's healthy the same
hours,
day.
Yeah.
You know,
24 yeah.
hours. Is that more though of an understanding of how the physical nature is of birth rather than, you know, a payer saying we need to get him out of the hospital, though?
I think it's a combination of both. Mm-hmm. I think it's a combination of medical advancements and techniques that we're using. I think that helps with length of stay. There's also challenges around safe discharges. So someone may need a safe discharge plan. Maybe they had a caregiver at home and that person's not there anymore. So where do they go for that? Well, we're trying to make arrangements for, you know, attendant care at the home, or maybe they want to go to an assisted living facility, or maybe to an independent living facility, and those resources aren't as prevalent as what they were pre-pandemic. So that affects where the payer is saying, perhaps you no longer need to be in your hospital, but there's not a safe discharge plan for them to go. So they end up staying in our hospital till we can find a place for them to go. So we spend a lot of time. We have a very large team that works trying to make that happen for the patient's best interest.
Now, a lot has been said over time about staff shortages, not just here, but nationwide, probably worldwide, I would imagine. You know, people leaving because COVID was too much for them to bear, you know, just too much stress, too much work, too much, you know, am I going to get sick? Am I going to die doing my job, taking care of people? What kind of things are in place or planned or we looking at to increase those people or get people into the field again, or bring people back in? Is there anything?
Yeah, sure. So there's a couple of things, anywhere from participating in school career fairs here locally, working with different colleges and universities so that people that are studying in the medical field, be it an imaging tech or an RN, can do their clinical rotations here. Ruth Frank's done a great job partnering with both LCC and also Southwestern Community College down south of us here to really have nurses do clinical rotations here. So that is very helpful from that perspective. The other thing that we do is housing. It was a challenge pre-pandemic. pandemic still is, but we've developed some unique strategies where housing hotlines, so anyone we hire or anyone that's currently with us that's looking for housing, they can look at a master list, and not only just in Florence, but the Oregon network. And we've also done some creative things where we are reserving some apartments here in town so people can land here and get started for 6 months until they can find a more permanent place. So those are some of the things we're doing. Really glad to hear at kind of the height of the pandemic, probably 2 years ago, we had as many as 40 temporary traveling nurses, imaging techs, and lab techs. And we're down to 10 now, which is really pre-pandemic levels. So we've been able to actually have some success recruiting, both I think in the hospital and in the medical group side in the last couple of years. And then really in the last 6 months, we're getting more and more people wanting to work in a community hospital our size. And of course, Florence is a great place to live. And so we have a really good fighting chance to land people here.
Well, and I think from a national effort, I think there's a lot going in to try to build some training programs. But locally, this is one thing I've been focusing on. It's interesting that so many places, I think people apply and then it says you need 3 years experience, you need 3 years experience. We've here been able to hire several, for example, nurse practitioners. They come right out of school. But to do that, I wanted to make sure that we had a good training program for them. As they're coming right out of school, we need to have some help to get them up to speed to take care. We have some fairly medically complex patients that live in our community, and we want to provide the best care possible for them. And so often I hear back from patients who say, well, why don't you have enough doctors? We need more doctors here. And we do, and we're actively trying to recruit more physicians to the area. And as you mentioned, a lot of physicians left practice, and it's going to take a while for that pipeline to catch up, right? Their medical schools are full, residencies are filling, but the training program for physicians is a much longer process than to get a nurse practitioner through or to get a PA through. And so to try to supplement that, here locally, we've created a training program for our newer practitioners. We have one of our physicians we have a physician here locally that's been helping in the outpatient setting, and then we have one of our hospital-based physicians who's actually pioneering a program here, and Oregon Network is actually looking at our program going, wow, you are doing a great job training, helping shadow with these new providers, do a training session. We call it didactics, but it's a training session with them, working on cases to help bring them up to the level that will help them to be successful and provide the care that we expect for these patients. And so it's been really awesome to have. We've had several new practitioners that we've hired, and we're trying very hard to meet the primary care needs, especially of our patients.
And I guess when you have that core mentorship there available, that those years of experience kind of pile. I mean, you know, you can't do 3 years in 1 year. I know that, but it's still, it compacts the amount of training they're able to get and increases their skill level probably incrementally with those mentors in place.
It does. It also provides almost a fail-safe or a backup so that they have someone they can always call. I call it on speed dial, right? Mm-hmm. That they always have someone that they can text or call when they have a case that they're just feeling overwhelmed by, or what's the right thing to do here. And we want them always to have that available to them as well, because we ultimately want the best care possible for these patients. So it's been awesome. Just in the last 6 months, we've been able to hire two nurse practitioners, Sadie Harmon, Ezra Harmon, that came from graduation and came to start with us, which has been fantastic.
Talked with them both. Yeah
they're great. Yeah. And then we were able to get Sharon DeHart from NovaCare to come over, and she brought several of her patients with her, which has been great. And then we're also going to be bringing Corey Gibbons on to family practice, and he's coming with not straight out of school, but he will need some additional moving from the program he was in into family practice. So we're continuing to see light at the end of the tunnel, trying to help shore up our primary care program as we recognize there's just such a tremendous need still for that support of primary care here locally.
Mm-hmm. Clinic's still staying extremely busy at this point in time?
Extremely busy, and we still have a significant wait list that, despite our best efforts, continues to stay pretty large, and we continue to see needs from not just Florence, but the surrounding communities also. As that's one thing I would add, and I'm sure Jason can speak to that as well, but we've also seen one of the things that's happened with the pandemic is smaller organizations seem to have taken big hits, and as they may not have the resource that Peace Health is able to help sustain us with, we've seen other programs close or other sites close, and such as the loss of NovaCare locally. And so being able to absorb some of that, and those patients are needing primary care, for example, they need emergency care. And so we're continuing to see our site need to fill the need for these patients. And so as we've continued to grow and grow and grow, the need keeps getting bigger. And so that was one thing as I was meeting with staff yesterday, just recognizing we just have to keep going, keep pushing, keep trying to provide.
one of the things that has been touchy over the last couple months is the closure of palliative care. We got so many calls from people, you know, some that were in the hospital system, some that were just local residents wanting to know what was happening. Can you give me a little background on what led up to that decision?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about that. And so certainly we all agree that palliative care is beloved and adored program by the community and had such an impact on so many families here in Florence. I guess the best way to kind of maybe approach this is that Peace Health is kind of organized in maybe four divisions: the hospital division, the provider and medical group division, the system office, and the home and community division. Palliative care is in the home and community division that represents home health, hospice, and palliative care services. So throughout the last 12 months, all those divisions have been looking at ways to re-engineer ourselves, to remain competitive that way from a financial standpoint because of things we talked about earlier in the show. Hospitals have been trying to reduce, reliance on traveling nurses and others because they're very expensive. Good at what they do, but expensive, of course. I think in the medical group's been doing the same thing and trying to reduce their reliance on temporary help and continue to offer services. The system office has done a tremendous amount of re-engineering as well to reduce cost. The thing that hit us the most here locally was that the home and community division across all of Peace Health, was a decision to close the palliative care offices, which we probably had one of the larger offices in terms of and the patients that we took care of here and had a very robust program and a very talented staff.
Is that because of the age and health of our community?
I think we were one of the earlier programs, and I think we had the ability to grow and adapt and adopt things that were really valuable for our community. And a lot of it started with donations. You know, there were some very nice donors that way. But unfortunately, components of palliative care, the provider components get reimbursed, but the social work and the nursing components, the chaplain services, as those costs are ones areas that are needed the most. But the back to the payment methodologies are not compensated. So those things get out of balance, and unfortunately, those changes were made. And now we're, instituting bringing upon a new program. You might want to talk a little bit about in-home primary care. That's going to help. Hopefully take a sting out of this a little bit for our community.
Going to fill the gap a little bit, maybe?
A little bit. I mean, yeah. I first want to recognize the amazing efforts that palliative care has done over the last 7 years. I think it's been a huge sting for all of us, and there's a lot of grieving going on, both for the employees that we've lost and for the service that they've given. And I'm so grateful to them for that work, and I recognize the anger and the frustration that the community is feeling and trying very hard to listen and see what we can do to respond in the best way we can to support these needs. Right away, I had already been working on a program to try to provide primary care for these patients, and it just worked out timing-wise. We were able to get it up and going more quickly than we anticipated. So it's an in-home primary care program. And that program, it's been called a couple different names so far. I think it's going to land with in-home primary care. Listeners might have heard advanced primary care out there in the wind as well, but we're going to, I think, land with in-home primary care. We were able to get two providers that were working with the palliative care program to come over to that program. And it's going to – we've already been able to take all of those patients that were in the palliative care program and transition them over to have a primary care provider in this new in-home program. They will continue to receive visits in their home or in their facility, which is really important. We have many of those patients – our facility-based patients, and so we're able to provide that same care to them in their facility. Thankfully, the palliative care team worked tirelessly to make sure that every one of them received that communication. So I'm hoping very much that they all did receive that communication, that we've been able to move the same phone number that the palliative care team had over to this new service line, the in-home primary care. And then we're able to use some of the services that we have in primary care to support them. So if you think about what our primary care team has locally, things like our refill team, our triage nurses, our transitional care nurses, lots of other teams that we have that exist in primary care that are very supportive, robust teams, they're all going to be able to support this new in-home primary care service that we're going to be providing. And then we're going to work with, for example, our mobile integrated health team, which is our paramedic that comes out and goes into the homes. She's going to be able to continue to support these patients. And then we're also going to be working with our home health team locally so that they can support these patients with nursing needs and wound care needs. And if they need PT or physical therapy, they would be able to provide that, for example, home health aides, that kind of thing. And then if the patient were to be transitioning to hospice, we would continue to work with hospice as the team was doing before with palliative care. So there's a lot that exists. There's still a lot more to come. There's a lot of needs still that we recognize. And one of the things that the palliative care team had was a huge group of volunteers that do amazing work. And we're still working on some ways to have those volunteers still have a meaningful purpose. We don't want to lose that. And so we're working with some local community partners to try to find a way to make that work, because I don't want to lose them and their amazing efforts. Mm-hmm. And I think the patients and their families and those in our community know the work they've done. And so we're still working on a way to do that. It's by no means a replacement for the work that palliative care was able to do. It's a start. And so I'm excited for the start. I'm excited for a way to help. But I know there's a lot of work still coming.
And there's effort there to get some of that done?
Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of support for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I want to mention that there's kind of the clinical component that Dr. MacArthur talked about, and then she alluded to kind of the companionship and transportation needs and spiritual care needs and things like that, and really trying to see, we're working with a nonprofit here in town and our foundation and trying to see if there's a way to shore that up a little bit more, and that component that isn't really covered by insurance or government payers. So I think that's the piece that is going to, you know, like Florence does, comes together as a great community and tries to take care of each other. So it takes a village, as I say. So I'm anxious for that step to come into a little more clarity over the next few weeks or months.
One of the questions I've heard from the community is the Peace Health, Peace Harbor Medical Center Foundation had gotten money from, you know, people that care about the system and about palliative care and that. What, if anything, can be done with that money to shore up some of the missing links in this?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because it's one of the things we initially wanted to take a look at was the intent of what the donors had wanted, and those services were provided in palliative care, and we're starting to replicate those services in the in-home primary care model that Dr. MacArthur's talking about. So we have approached the foundation, and we'll continue to start to work through that in more formal channels to have those things meet the intent of the donor, to offer to take care of maybe a community health worker, help for those kind of services, spiritual care, those kind of things, social worker that would be in the in-home primary care model. So while it may not be in the palliative care model, it'll meet the intent of the donor and it'll be taking care of those patients in that capacity.
Because you're part of a bigger health organization with Peace Health, is there any leeway or any autonomy here to continue some of those services with foundation money?
Yes, and I think that's exactly what we're trying to do. With the foundation has a separate Peace Harbor Medical Center Foundation, has its own governing board here, and the funds that are raised here locally stay local. And in this case, with a program closure, our foundation stood up right away to ask some questions about, okay, how can we reallocate these funds into the right space to meet the intent of the donors? And I think using them in this direction makes a lot of sense. I think the donors would hopefully be appreciative of that.
So it was a rocky end, earthquake kind of shake up there, but you see some good coming out or some stabilization coming out?
Well, I think there was 153 patients that were currently actively being seen in a palliative care program. All 153 of those patients are being transitioned with care plans, have the ability to get their meds refilled, have the ability to talk to a medical assistant or a provider, have patients either being visited at home or in the facility they're in. Recovering that, when we get into those care plans and we start looking at things, there will be some gaps, and we'll have to sort out how we fill those gaps as those present ourselves. But right now, we're working towards that. By no means can we replicate, as you said earlier, what palliative care did, but we're working darn hard to try to make sure that we take care of our community.
Any closing thoughts?
Just, I would just say the focus continues to be on the patients, right? And in the end, as we've talked about, Peace Health's mission is mission focused, and that mission has to land on the patient every time and doing the right thing. And I know this has been incredibly frustrating. The loss of palliative care seems like counterintuitive for that mission. And I know that's been very, very frustrating for the community to hear, for our employees to hear. It's been very, very difficult. And so I am very grateful to those who've been patient with us and have given me the grace to keep working forward to try to find solutions together. Because ultimately, my focus has been on making sure these patients have at least a safe place to land and that we have something in place. We have a lot of work still ahead of us. But ultimately, trying to do the right thing for them remains the goal.
Dr. Heather MacArthur, Jason Hawkins, thank you so much for being here today and shedding some light on some of these difficult times, and appreciate it.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, George.
Finishing out the June edition of Our Town will be Russ Pearson, the dean of Lane Community College here in Florence, now in Cottage Grove as well. Coming up.